the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome again to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, today we continue the best of our guest show from the last year.
So as we did last week, Kevin, this week we have Mark Faber, G. Edward Griffin, Richard Bookstaber, Bill King, and a whole host of other guests who will join us, and we'll go back to the interviews that we had earlier this year in 2009 to see just how we have seen the evolution. The evolutionary process from simply a financial crisis to an economic, now to a political, and ultimately to a geopolitical crisis if we don't come up with the right solution.
And once again, we will give the dates to each of the shows from the clips that we're playing so that our listeners can go back to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary archives at our site at McIlvaney.com to listen to the full show if they'd like to.
With several of our guests, we look back in time to have an understanding historically, and with others, we look forward. Joining us in this initial clip is Mark Faber, and he looks ahead to what may be the next big bubble, and that's from July 8th.
Now, the next big bubble, I think, is in government spending. I think Mr. Obama is dreaming if he thinks that the deficit next year, which this year will run at, say, $2 trillion, that the deficit next will come down. I think it is likely to be even bigger next year. And so my view is in the long run, these deficits will be monetized. And when the time will come, when the Federal Reserve should increase interest rates to essentially combat price increases or protect the value of the dollar, they will not be in a position to do so or will not wish to do so because, you understand, as the government debt grows, the interest expense on the government debt goes up. It's going to be, in a year's time, around $500 billion annually. Now, if you then increase interest rates, then obviously the interest expenditure on the government debt goes up and the deficits don't come down.
And Dr. Faber comments on how the financial and economic morphs into the geopolitical and how they tie together.
What is happening in the world from time to time is that you have major shifts in the balance of power. Say at the end of the 19th century, you had two developments. First of all, the rise of Germany that had a GDP that in 1910 then exceeded British GDP. That led to tensions between the then superpower Britain and the rising power, the rising industrial power, Germany. They came to war. And at about the same time, the U.S. economy became dominant, and I would say the place in the sun of the U.S. then expanded after the First World War and after the Second World War. And relative to the rest of the world, probably the U.S. reached its peak in the early 1960s. And then in the 70s, the U.S. started to lose out some of its industries to Japan and to countries like South Korea and Taiwan and so forth. And now over the last 20 years, obviously, the Western world has had much slower growth than, say, countries like India and China and the rest of Asia. And so there is a huge shift in the balance of power. All I can tell you, whenever you have these major shifts in history, in the balance of power, economic power I'm talking about, then you also have huge geopolitical tensions coming up. I think the U.S. economy will eventually recover when the next world war happens.
Kevin, the July 29th interview with G. Edward Griffin was one of the most popular of the year. In fact, the transcript was used in publications across the country, and we're just going to give one brief clip here, but those are shows that are worth the time and energy expended to go back to the archives and listen to, and certainly his book worth getting a copy of.
So the purpose of the Federal Reserve is to protect and increase the profits of the banks. It's not there to defend the interests of the American people, because it's a cartel of the banks. So we're looking at this game, and most people don't even know who the players are and where their loyalties are. And so they don't know how it works. Here's basically, I'm going to have to condense this down, of course, but the banks, knowing that they have their cartel agreement enforced by law, are not too concerned about losses because they know that no matter what decisions they make, business decisions, and no matter to whom they loan the money, if the loans go sour, they can absorb small losses. But when the big losses come down the line, they know that they can eventually go to Congress, their partners in Congress, and say, hey, we need money to make up these losses, and we need it because it's in the interest of the American people. You know, we don't want the economy to collapse. We don't want the banking system to collapse. We don't want these corporations to go out of existence. And look at all of the thousands of people who would lose their jobs. And a lot of these workers, you know, their families, and they have little children, and little children wouldn't have milk to drink. And, you know, they go into all this heartstring stuff when basically they're just trying to cover the reality, which is they want taxpayer money to bail out their bad business decisions.
David, we had a fascinating guest on August 19th, of course, Richard Buchstaber, author of A Demon of Our Own Design. Here's the question that you asked him, and I thought the answer was fascinating.
Maybe we can talk a little bit about the unpredictable triggers and the role of regulation in this incredibly complex system, where regulation can, in fact, be the straw that breaks the camel's back.
Right. One of the concerns that I have, and I've been trying to be active in the debate on regulation, is that if you do regulation the wrong way, it's not just that it doesn't solve the problem, it actually can exacerbate the problem, can make things worse. And to illustrate this point, in my book, I go through some cases of risk in other industries than finance, actually in industries where failure can mean loss of lives as opposed to somebody losing some money, namely the airline industry and the nuclear power industry. And in both those industries, there's an area of engineering that looks at what are called normal accidents. The concept of normal accidents, which was originated by a professor at Yale, Charles Perrow, is that if you have an engineering system that is both complex and tightly coupled, where tightly coupled means when an event begins, it continues on without the opportunity to quickly intervene. So a tightly coupled system, like a space shuttle launching, is a tightly coupled process. A nuclear power plant moving toward criticality is tightly coupled. You can't sort of pull an emergency switch and say, okay, let's convene a committee, figure out what's going on, get back together Tuesday at 3 o'clock. So if you have tight coupled systems that are also complex, you inevitably are going to have accidents, and thus they're called normal accidents because the system by its structure is going to have accidents. And the important thing is that, you know, the reaction to this would be, oh, well, if that's the case, let's put on some safety measures to reduce the probability of the accidents that are coming about through this complexity and tight coupling. Well, the problem is, if you add safety measures into a system that already is prone to normal accidents, you might just increase the likelihood of such accidents, because think of what your safety measures are doing. They're adding yet another layer of complexity. Now, this may sound like an esoteric argument, but in my book, I cite three examples, ValueJet, Three Mile Island, and Chernobyl, where you had tightly coupled complex systems that ended up having accidents, you know, critical accidents, due to regulation-based safety measures. In the case of Chernobyl, it was a regulatory-based safety test. In the case of ValueJet, the problem was oxygen generators that regulation required as a safety measure. So the point is that insofar as the financial system is a system that has complexity, which I believe it does through innovative securities, and is tightly coupled, which I believe it is because of both the ability to operate and trade so rapidly around the clock and because of the effects of leverage and the resulting liquidity crisis cycle, then if you have regulation that's done improperly, rather than solving the problem, it may make it worse.
And also from this interview was this dialogue.
Doesn't it somewhat turn modern portfolio theory on its head in terms of there being more correlation than expected across asset classes?
Yeah, it's basically when there's a crisis, all of a sudden correlations move to one. And what that means, yeah, for modern portfolio theory, this is an important result because it means that diversification, which is sort of at the foundation of modern portfolio theory, diversification, you know, spreading your positions out around a lot of different markets so that if one goes down, maybe the other one's going up, will work all of the time except when it really matters, except when there's a crisis. And then you can end up with markets that you thought had nothing to do with each other suddenly moving the same way. You know, a great example of this, by the way, besides LTCM, is, you know, going back even further, looking at what happened during the Hunt silver bubble. You know, in 1980, the Hunt brothers captured a lot of the silver market. Silver went up almost to $40 an ounce. And then the bubble burst, and the Hunt brothers were getting margin call after margin call because they had leveraged so much in that market. Well, they had to get capital from someplace to meet their margin requirements, and it turned out that one of the other markets they were big in was cattle, which I guess isn't so surprising. You know, if you're in Texas, it would either be cattle or oil. So they started to liquidate their cattle exposure, and you ended up with this correlation that was very, very high between cattle and silver. Both of them were tanking at the same time. You know, who could have possibly predicted that? But that's another example of where sort of the notion of diversification, the notion of separation of markets breaks down. And the reason it breaks down is because of this liquidity crisis cycle that's leverage-induced.
On September 16th, Bill King joined us from Chicago, Illinois.
Don't think people understand completely what is at stake, what's really going on here. And this is not trying to save the stock market like after the 1987 crash. This is not 1989, we were trying to save the stock market after the United Airlines crash. This is not 91, 92 recession when the money center banks were gone, were down, and Greenspan did the carry trade to save them. This is not 94 when Mexico went down, or 97, the Asian contagion, or 98, long-term capital market in Russia, or Y2K fares, or even this is not 2001, 2 when you had a technology, when the great tech bubble blew up and the technology industry went into depression. This is beyond anything we've seen. This is trying to save the Fed and the Treasury. I mean, they're all in. They're betting their, not just reputation, they're betting their structure, their mission. But more importantly, you're betting the U.S. political, you know, welfare state crony capitalist system. That's why this is such a vicious fight. That's why they've already spent trillions and they've backstopped most everything with tens of trillions. Because this is all in. You're betting the Roosevelt-era U.S. economic, financial, and political system. It's an enormous bet.
And here are Bill's comments on what has supported the dollar for years.
And people know this. The bet the U.S. is making is that China has to keep supporting the dollar and buying U.S. debt. And if they don't, they have Armageddon over there. And, of course, so would we. But that's the bet. This is kind of the almost like the mutual assured destruction, the mad policy we had with Russia with nuclear arms. Well, this time we're doing it with the weapons of mass destruction in the financial system. That's the bet. And China keeps saying, no, no, stop this, you guys can't keep doing this. There's three big things they've been saying. They don't want the trade tariffs or trade restrictions, which is now occurring. They want the U.S. to stop the profit good spending, which has not occurred and is not likely. Good luck with that. And the other thing is to stop the quantitative easing, which is a euphemism for monetizing debt. And even though Bernanke went to Congress for what a month ago and said, no, I'm not going to monetize the debt, he's been doing it since March. You know, that's what quantitative easing is. It's monetizing the debt. And that's their complaints.
And these were Bill King's comments on inflation and the impact.
The reason hyperinflation is so bad is you destroy the middle class and the merchant class because of this. They can't hedge. They can't move around fast enough with their businesses, and they can't move their wealth around. And that's the difference between the U.S. and everybody else in the world is that we have this merchant class, middle class, mom-and-pop businesses that generate 70% or even higher of your jobs, and you destroy them. That's the problem when you start doing the funny money. What we've done here for decades is the slow, methodical inflation. And that's what stocks like. Stocks like slow, methodical inflation. That's why stocks outperform gold in that kind of period, because companies can pass the cost on better. They have better leverage. Gold gets excited in either serious deflation or when people fear the inflation is going to grow fast enough that the merchant class can't keep up with it. And that's what's going on now. Again, it's this outgrowth of Keynesianism where we can always paper over our problems. And we've been doing it for so long, they think they can keep getting away with it. And, I mean, that's the bet now, that they can keep getting away with this stuff. And, you know, when you look at the math, it just there's no way you're going to pay this debt. There's no conceivable way.
Just a reminder, you're listening to excerpts from the 2009 season of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. Join us each week at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, for the next show.
So you got two choices. You either paper it away, try to paper it away, or you're going to default on it. And this is the one argument, all the people that want to say, well, we're going to hyperinflate. I said, based on what? Like, well, look at Zimbabwe. I go, you really want to compare Zimbabwe? And they go, oh, no, you can't, but look at Germany. I go, okay, fine. That's one instance. Look at all the other people, especially recent history, post-World War II, that have gotten into problem with too much debt. How many of them have run hyperinflation? None. What has happened, though? They default.
And here are Bill's comments on whether the worst is behind us yet.
Until you see real restructuring of the U.S. economy and political system, you won't have a real bottom. You're just not going to get it. You people want to compare 1982 to what happened now. That's not even close. We had enormous change. We moved from an inflationary paper over economy to a real production, you know, Volcker driving the inflation out of system, Reagan running the economic war against the Soviet Union, which also drove inflation out of system, unleashing capitalism. We had the biggest boom in job creation since decades in the 80s, and it was the biggest boom ever for women, minority, and small business. That's what you have to do again. We know it has to be done, but it doesn't go with the political agenda. And that's why we're having the problem. And that's what Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize winner in economics, said. We have worse problems now than we did a year ago because of all the things you're doing, all the papering over. You're making failed banks that were too big to fail even bigger, and you haven't resolved any of their problems. And until we get the true restructuring, you know, it's just more of the same, more of what we've been doing, create another asset bubble to paper over the problems, have it blow up, you know, throw more money. Where does it end? Nobody knows. Nobody knows where this thing finally, you just come in and, you know, the dollar, the bond market, whatever, is saying, you know what, that's it. You can't do that anymore. But that's the big one to watch, the bond market.
And on November 4th, we had Greg Weldon of the Weldon Money Monitor addressing whether the underlying fundamentals have actually changed or whether they've just been padded over.
The secular underlying fundamental remains negative because you really haven't addressed, you've stabilized, but you haven't addressed the problems in U.S. housing. You've stabilized and helped the consumer in the U.S. somewhat repair his balance sheet with a lower debt load and a higher savings rate, but not to the point where they're going to be able to pursue growth in consumption anywhere near the pace that we've seen in the past. So I still think there are a lot of problems, and we haven't even begun to discuss commercial real estate in the U.S., which is a new and very much accelerating problem right now. So what we have now is you're going to probably see the return of the underlying fundamentals as a negative, how that reflects in the markets, and then how that puts pressure on officialdom to respond again with more stimulus. I think it will happen. It's a question of when, and more importantly, it's a question of what happens between now and then that forces that move. How much pain will we need to potentially endure or go through before, you know, you get a response from officialdom? And again, you know, I always put in the caveat that there are no academically correct answers here because the time for that is 15 years ago. The time now is more the human condition, and it's pain avoidance. And when you get the politics involved, it really extrapolates that pain avoidance mentality, the human survival instinct, when it's also the survival of your job, so to speak, politically. So I think that that makes it pretty intense.
Weldon goes on to say that there's greater implications for those in positions of political power coming directly from their constituents.
The secular trend is still for the polarization of wealth. You see that, I mean, one of the most glaring places to see that is the employment report. When you break down wages, for example, the people that are lucky enough to still be working are working less hours and they're making less money. The average weekly earnings is down and down, you know, threatening to fall into a record, really a historic pace of deflation. So I think that this is highly problematic and has not been addressed by any of this government support. You know, I don't see job one having been created as a result.
Do you expect to see a bear market in credit and a bear market in bonds?
It's a huge question. It may be the question because this will be a real litmus test. I really believe that certainly in the U.S. and globally as well, that the situation is not healthy enough yet to withstand, you know, higher interest rates. That's not to say that rates from where they are couldn't be lifted and, you know, that still money is cheap. I get that argument, but to me it's kind of a moot argument because to me any tightening has the potential to really disrupt things. And if the U.S. bond market were to take a hit here, I just don't see how the U.S. is going to be able to withstand higher rates and potentially then a higher dollar because I think that would impact very negatively on the equity market and on the macro economy too.
Is there the potential for round two in terms of a financial crisis? I mean, we haven't gotten to the place, arguably, where the economy is recovering, which was the intention of the stimulus to begin with. At least that's the way it was advertised. But again, back to the very genesis of this crisis, it began with the banks. And doesn't there still rest with the banks a significant amount of risk?
I would say a significant amount, absolutely, maybe an understatement. You could even, you know, kind of tilt this to suggest, and I'm not saying this, but let's play devil's advocate for a second. If you look at the stats, the FDIC, their quarterly banking profile, a great report. It's long, it's detailed, but there's so much information in there. It's a very valuable report. The first thing I need to say is it shows that despite what the pop media has championed as a large set-aside, that reserves have been increased by billions and billions of dollars, and this is such a good thing because now banks are healthier and more able to withstand, you know, potential increase in turbulence, that is just not true. They have certainly set aside a lot of money, but non-performing loans continues to increase at a faster rate than they're setting aside reserves. Their reserve ratio still falling at a record low, nearing 50%. So meaning that they have less than 50% of what they might need reserved against potential loan losses. This is highly problematic when you throw in the fact that regional banks, okay, and the smaller banks, you know, the banks that are, you know, 1 to 10 billion in capitalization are the ones that have made the most loans into the commercial property development and construction arena, okay, and this is where just now you're starting to see from a high level an acceleration to the upside in terms of default and delinquency rates. This is highly problematic for the banking system, and this is why you see constantly the administration and the FDIC and you know anyone in the know tell you that bank failures are going to increase perhaps significantly over the next 12 months because they know this is coming down the pike. As the commercial real estate market rolls over in a more pronounced way fundamentally, this becomes highly problematic for the banking system, which has not taken into account the possibility for this and is very poorly prepared to withstand a deflation in commercial property market, simply because, I mean, one part of this report shows the number of banks that have more than 100% of their capital dedicated to commercial property and development loans, development and construction loans. That's a scary stat when the reserves are, you know, a couple percent, and when the delinquency rate is hitting 12%, and when the vacancy rate is higher, and the cap rates are higher, and the rents are falling, and so on and so forth, and all of a sudden, you got one of the largest single-week declines in commercial real estate loans outstanding. That's a lot to get your arms around, and when I try and look at that as a whole, it suggests to me that the banks may have a whole nother crisis of significant proportions coming.
David, on November 11th, we had a fascinating guest, Bernard Lewis, and I guess what I want to ask you is, what were you thinking when you wanted to have him on speaking about the Middle East?
He's the foremost expert on Islam in the Western world. He's been at Princeton for 50-plus years, and his book, The Crisis of Islam, is a great introduction to the history and background and is a must-read, I would say, for every listener. So certainly go back to the archives and listen to this one in toto.
Well, let's go to that clip.
So looking at the different jurists' interpretation of holy war, what kind of interpretation was necessary during the Iran-Iraq war, where there was a different kind of treatment of children and of women, and perhaps even in northern Iraq during the slaughter of the Kurds?
I would say they are mostly acting in violation of their own holy law. And I'm thinking in particular of the matter of suicide. Islam is strongly against suicide. Suicide in any form is totally forbidden. It is laid down that even if a man has lived a life of unremitting virtue and observed all the laws all through his life, if he commits suicide, he forfeits that and goes straight to hell. And the eternal damnation of the suicide is the endless repetition of the act by which he committed suicide. So these people can presumably look forward to an eternity of exploding bombs. But they don't seem to know that.
It seems that to accomplish recruitment in the context of suicide bombing, that you're really talking about a socioeconomic manipulation, if you will, where people are not given that particular chapter and verse in the Quran.
No, exactly. And most of them are fairly simple, ignorant people.
David, on November the 18th, we had a provocative discussion with Naomi Wolf, the New York Times best-selling author, who outlined the steps to fascism.
Naomi, you discussed 10 steps, the blueprint for fascism, or a move towards closing down an open society. maybe you could put those elements in that step sequence so that our listeners have an idea of what it takes to either maintain power for a dictator or those who desire dictatorial power, what they have to have in place to enable that.
Sure. Yeah, it's really amazing and important to understand these 10 steps because they are universal and they sort of transcend history and they transcend ideology. Well, the first thing, in The End of America, I made the case for your listeners who are not familiar with that book that what we were seeing in the United States in the Bush years, and I would argue stepped up in some ways in the Obama years, or certainly continuing, is the effort of a small group of people systemically to subvert an open, pluralistic society and make it a closed society. And what I wrote about in The End of America is how Bush was taking the same 10 steps to create a closed society that you see in closed societies ranging from, you know, Mussolini's takeover of Italy, which was a fragile pluralistic democracy in 1920, to the ascendancy of the Nazis completely legally in the early 30s, to Germany, East Germany in the 50s, Czechoslovakia in the 60s, the Argentine coup in 1973, China's crackdown on a democracy movement at the end of the 80s and beginning of the 90s. And so what I saw was it doesn't matter if you're on the left or the right. If you want to close down an open society there's like a toolkit. And all dictators do the same thing. And so it is so important for citizens around the world. It's been so gratifying to have an audience, you know, it's increasingly global, be able to recognize these quickly and take counter steps quickly.
Kevin, we've cut that last clip short. Of course, that whole program can be listened to in the archives, and you can listen to all 10 steps. Next, we'll look at some practical considerations that Naomi left us with.
There's something in there that I call creating a democracy commando team. It's actually not my phrasing. It's my sources. I might make it a little bit more peaceful now that there's we're getting so much response that I'm anxious about kind of a neo-militarized language. But let's say a democracy action team where you register to vote 30 or 40 of your fellow citizens, friends, and neighbors. That's all it takes. And you make sure that you all vote in the congressional elections because your congressperson doesn't care about you if they can't see your name on those voter rolls, I discovered. But if you go then to your district office, right, your congressman's district office, and you talk to the staff at the district office, and you say, here is my group, 30 to 40 people. They're voting in the congressional elections, and I'm going to help your guy or girl get elected the next time around or cause trouble for his or her reelection if you don't do X or Y for me and my group. That, he said, my source said, who works on Capitol Hill, is like a neutron bomb, although I have to stop using military metaphors. That gives you more power than the lobbyists because they have to make these phone calls and accept this money from the lobbyists to buy airtime to persuade you and your 30 friends. So if you say, I can deliver these 30 friends and make it easier or harder for your guy or girl in the next election, you get the hearing. You get a seat at the table.
On December 2nd, we had Paul Craig Roberts on. You know, he was the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury under the Reagan administration, and he sees things from the inside out. I mean, he really has, David, been an insider.
Let's go right to that clip. Explain a little bit, if you would, the cost of the average soldier in Afghanistan, what it costs us to even fuel the projects that we have there. We've got jeeps and tanks and all kinds of armored personnel carrier running around the desert, and we're spending vast sums of money. Perhaps you could give a brief critique of how that money is being spent, who it's being given to, and why that is a part of the problem.
Well, I can only do so on the basis of reports, and it's been reported that it costs the United States government $775,000 per soldier in Afghanistan per year. So that's over $750,000 per soldier per year in Afghanistan. And then the Pentagon recently told the House Armed Services Committee, and it's all, you know, available in the news and on Google, that a gallon of gasoline in Afghanistan, by the time it was delivered to wherever it was going to be used, cost the government $400.
Talking about the ancillary costs of, you know, if you factored in all the costs of the war into a gallon of gas, it would cost $400. You're saying that's a standalone figure. This is just one line item cost, $400 per gallon?
The Pentagon simply told them that by the time they got the gasoline over there, got it in a convoy, paid off the Taliban not to attack it, paid off all the warlords not to attack it, and got it delivered, And sometimes they have to deliver it in fuel cells from helicopters. Did it cost them $400 per gallon just to get the gasoline there? So the costs are horrific. And, of course, the reported costs of the war, as Joe Stiglitz made clear, they don't include the replacement cost of the equipment, the lifelong medical care of the veterans, or the opportunity cost of using the resources to build our economy. And so the true cost, you know, is much, much greater than the currently appropriated cost.
Then Paul Craig Roberts said this about the deficits.
The real problem is the budget deficit now is about four times the size of the trade surpluses that OPEC and China and Japan have with us. So even if they were willing to continue to pour the surpluses back into treasury bonds, it's still not enough to finance the budget deficit. It's just too large. You see, Bush's last one was around $450 billion, so that's financeable through the trade surpluses that our so-called trading partners have. But when it becomes four times that size, it dwarfs the trade surpluses. So where does the rest of it come from? It doesn't come from Americans who are heavily in debt and losing their houses and losing their jobs. And so the only other place it can come from is they print the money, or the stock market collapses again and investors flee into treasury bonds, which is habitual. They think that that's safe.
Kevin, our interview with Paul Craig Roberts ends the 2009 wrap-up. And for those who are not familiar with the commentary, it is released every Wednesday at our website, www.mcilvaney.com. That's MCALVANY.com.
It's really been a fascinating year. I mean, the guests that we've had have answered many of the questions that we came into the discussion with. And really, David, the invitation is to each of these listeners to come in every Wednesday, click on and download the latest show. You can actually do it any day, but each Wednesday is when the new show is posted.
For over 2 years, Kevin, we've taken this program and the kind of conversations that we have internally here at our company and have extended that out and invited people in to have this dialogue with us about ideas, about trends, about transitions, about where we're at and where we're going in light of a historical perspective. These are the kinds of things that make for the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.
Well, and I'm looking forward to 2010. You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. That's MCALVANY.com. Or call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.